Hello, this is Mrs. English, and today I will be reading to you from the Robert Fitzgerald translation of Virgil's Aeneid. You need a copy of Robert Fitzgerald's Aeneid to follow along in the read aloud and to be able to mark your book up appropriately. You also need your 6 pages of notes that you got on session 25 that have a basic outline of all 12 books of the Aeneid. Now remember, the Trojan War was 10 years. It was from 1194 to 1184 BC, and these are counting backwards, so because we're in the BC years. And the Trojan War is over. 1184, the Trojan War ends. The Greeks have burned down the city of Troy, and there are a few Trojans left. And this is where Aeneas pops up again. We saw him as a minor character in the Iliad, and now he's the major character. He's the protagonist for Virgil's Aeneid. And he spends 7 years kind of wandering around and building ships. And that takes us to about 1177 BC. And that would be presuming that any part of this is true in real history. Now, Virgil is our narrator, except in books 2 and book 3, where Aeneas tells his own story in the first person. As the narrator, Virgil can include action and dialogue of the gods and goddesses. And so that's an advantage too. It's not just he said this, she said this. Virgil acts as a narrator, and he can give it a cosmic stage. Now, the tense of this story is usually past tense, because Virgil is, as a narrator, telling something that happened in the past, except when he is inserting what he's going to call prophecy or prediction, or for a sense of urgency, we might slip to the first person. Now, the conflict of this story, of the Aeneid, Aeneas is fated to found a city in Italy and establish a race that will rule over others. This is key. This is the key conflict. This is the major thing about the Aeneid, is that the gods have already decided, not the gods and goddesses, but the fates. The fates have already decided he is going to begin a new city in Italy. He's going to establish a race to rule over others, and of course that's why he needs a wife from Italy, and so his original wife will die really quick here. Hera, Juno, she's called Juno here because we're now using the Roman names for the gods and goddesses, so you need to remember all the Roman names. Juno, Hera, wants vengeance against the Trojans for Paris's snub in the beauty contest. You remember the judgment of Paris. So she gets Aeneas and Dido to have an affair, and she's going to incite war between the Latins and the Trojans. And Virgil is going to tell this story in like a tragedy. It's told as a tragedy. All of the sad things that happened to Dido, it's as though it is tragic because it's fated to happen. It's not tragic because Aeneas leaves her and abandons her and is cruel to her. It is tragic because that's his fate. And this lets the Romans off of any responsibility. Remember, Virgil is telling this about 19 BC. He died 19 BC, so this is just before his death. In the rising action of the book, in part 1, which is books 1 through 6, they're very similar to the Odyssey in that it is a journey. These are the wanderings of Aeneas, and he's going to end up telling the story of his escape from the siege of Troy, so we hear this after the fact, and telling this story, especially heroically, being willing to go back for his wife, this is going to cause Dido to fall in love with him, and this is Venus's intention. Venus and Juno get Dido and Aeneas isolated in a cave during a hunting trip where there's a big rainfall, and Dido feels like they got married there. Aeneas thinks it's a stop on the way, and so this is going to cause great grief. But that's book 1 through 6. Then part 2, books 7 to 12, are very comparable to the Iliad. They are comparable to the Odyssey in the sense that we have a trip to the underworld, but comparable to the Iliad as far as it's war. It is warfare. We have King Latinus, once he finally gets to Italy, is going to offer his daughter Lavinia to Aeneas in marriage. This infuriates Juno because then she incites Queen Amata and Turnus, who loves Lavinia and thought he was going to marry her. So Turnus and his would-have-been mother-in-law, Queen Amata, Juno incites them, and the gates of war are opened. This is a major theme in the Aeneid, the gates of war. Turnus kills Aeneas' friend Pallas, and Turnus was thinking of mercy toward Aeneas was thinking of mercy toward Turnus, but when Turnus kills Aeneas' friend Pallas and shows up wearing his belt. This is very similar. And so Aeneas sees Pallas's belt on Turnus, realizing that Turnus has killed his best friend Pallas, and he goes crazy and he kills him. Aeneas kills Turnus. Now, this is very comparable to Achilles killing Hector when Hector is wearing Patroclus's armor, which is actually Achilles' armor that he loaned to him. So Patroclus wore that armor in the Iliad out to battle, hoping someone would think that it was actually Achilles, and then Hector killed Patroclus wearing Achilles' armor, and then, of course, Hector was wearing it when he went out to battle Achilles, and Achilles killed him, and that incited his anger. So we have so many comparables here between the Iliad Odyssey and the Aeneid. Now, the Aeneid, of course, written in Latin. We're reading an English version translated by Robert Fitzgerald, and everybody's going to have a couple of names. Ascanius is also called Ilias. The Teucrans, these are the original Trojans. Teucer would have been then the original king of Troy. The Danaans are the Greek. The Dardanians are the Trojans. Remember, we had to learn that the Iliad. Ilia is also Rhea Silvius, the Silvia, and Neoptolemus is also called Pyrrhus, the son of Achilles. Dardanus was the son of Jupiter and Electra, and he was the founder of Troy. Hesperia means western land, and that is referring to Italy because it is west of Troy, which is now common Turkey. If at any time we hear the word Punic, it is comparable to the word Carthage. The Punic Wars are the Carthaginian Wars. Anything Punic is also Carthage. We're just jumping back and forth with languages. Alba Longa is going to be the second home of the Trojans in Italy. They'll be there 300 years. We'll learn about that. The Parcae, that is the Latin form of the three fates. So the Parcae are the three fates. And Ausonia is just a reference to Italy. And I will bring these to your attention as I do the read aloud. Now, key themes that we're going to find in Virgil's Aeneid, the theme of fate. This is where the gods interfere, the humans suffer, and the gods and goddesses get what they want, and as long as they're not crossing fate. There's a searching for a homecoming. That would be another theme, trying to get home. Homecoming is a big deal in the ancient world because you don't always get to come home. And the glory of Rome descending from Troy. This is a huge theme because this is used as Roman propaganda to tie the Roman Empire, which is wanting to rule the entire world, tying them to these Trojans, these original great city of great glory. Now, this epic contains all types of things that are usual to epic. We're going to see Virgil invoke the muse. We will see long formal speeches. We have a cosmic stage where we learn what is going on up on Mount Olympus and on the earth. We have demigods. We have prophecies and we have foretelling. We have a foundation story, the foundation of Rome's future. And we have these heroic concepts of vengeance where to be merciful would be thought to be weak. We see these strong, heroic concepts of vengeance. Now, the symbols that we're going to see that are new to us include the golden bough. This doesn't occur till book 6, but the golden bough is how you get into the underworld, and that's a big deal. If you try to pluck off a piece of the bough, if it comes off into your hand, then you will get to go down in the underworld and come back. If it does not come off in your hand, you don't want to go down there. We hear about the gates of war, we'll learn that, and the Trojan hearth gods, the Penate, which they have taken from Troy and need to take those gods and take them to a place in Italy, and that will be where they will found a major city. So symbols include the golden bough, the gates of war, and these Trojan hearth gods. The audience is Rome. These are Romans just before the time of the birth of Jesus Christ. The audience is Rome. Now, initially, your first audience would be Augustus Caesar. He is the one who requested that this work be written. Virgil tells the story from a perspective in time 1,000 years before his own time. So Virgil tells this as though it is written right after the Trojan War and writes it as though these things are happening, when in reality, this is history that's 1,000 years prior. So what Virgil is doing is rewriting Roman history. And he makes this connection between Augustus Caesar and Aeneas, who of course is a demigod. And connecting Augustus Caesar with a demigod is essentially connecting him with the goddess Venus Aphrodite. And this gives Augustus Caesar more of a foundation for his right to rule. The past is presented as prophetic future. So we're writing from a point just before Christ, and it is as though it was written 1,000 years ago. So Virgil, of course, has all of the Roman history, which he rewrites to write in Augustus Caesar as a right to ruler. This story connects Aeneas with Venus and Augustus to Aeneas, and that's all that Virgil needs to do. Okay, let's get started with Book 1. Aeneas has been traveling 7 years. Juno causes a storm. Neptune, we called him Poseidon previously, he stops the storm, and they're driven off to Carthage. If you take a look at a map to go from Troy to Rome, you have to sail around the boot of Italy, and if you sail too far south or had a storm occur, you would be thrown right on the northern shore of Africa, and that's where Carthage is, and that's how he ends up in Carthage. So, and Virgil is using past tense to present this as though it's history. So he begins, and this again, Robert Fitzgerald's translation of Virgil's Aeneid. I sing of warfare and a man at war. Right here in line 1, we see the Iliad, war, talking about the anger of the gods. And then they begin talking about Achilles' anger. And then a man at war, and this would be comparable to the Odyssey. I sing of warfare and a man at war. From the sea coast of Troy in early days, he came to Italy by destiny, to our Lavinian western shore. When Virgil says our, he's already connecting his first century audience right to Aeneas. He's saying to these Romans in the first century, to our Lavinian western shore, which means Italy, a fugitive, this captain buffeted cruelly on land as on the sea by blows from powers of the air. Behind them, baleful Juno. So Hera is plaguing his quest to get home. Baleful Juno, Hera in her sleepless rage. Remember, she's angry about that beauty contest. And cruel losses were his lot in war, till he could found a city and bring home his gods to Latium, land of the Latin race. Now, this is Virgil's piety, because what's Aeneas doing? He's got to go found a city and bring home his gods to Latium. He has to take those penates, those gods, from Troy to Italy, which is Latium. It's another word for ancient Italy. His gods to Latium. So he's very religious. He's pious. Land of the Latin race, the Alban lords and the high walls of Rome. Tell me the causes now, O Muse. Here is Aeneas. Here is Virgil invoking the Muse. Tell me the causes now, O Muse, how galled in her divine pride, and how sore at heart from her old wound. This is Juno, Hera's old wound of not being called the most beautiful. The queen of gods compelled him, a man apart, devoted to his mission, to undergo so many perilous days and enter on so many trials. Can anger black as this prey on the minds of heaven? Can the gods and goddesses really be so evil and wicked to do this? For Juno's cruelty to plague his mission? Black as this prey on the minds of heaven? Line 20. Tyrian settlers in that ancient time held Carthage on the far shore of the sea, set against Italy and Tiber's mouth, a rich new town, warlike and trained for war. And Juno, we are told, cared more for Carthage than for any walled city of the earth, more than Samos even. All right, so Juno, Hera, has Carthage as her city and she loves it. There, her armor and her chariot were kept, and fate permitting, Carthage would be the ruler of the world. So Juno favors Carthage, and Juno Hera wants Carthage to be the ruler of the world, which means not Italy or Rome. So she intended, and so nursed that power. So the reader already knows, or the listener already knows, that Juno Hera is fighting against the fates, so she's going to lose. But this way we don't blame Aeneas, we blame the gods. Line 30, but she had heard long since that generations born of Trojan blood would one day overthrow her Tyrian walls, Carthaginian walls, and from that blood a race would come in time with ample kingdoms arrogant in war. For Libya, that's part of Africa, for Libya's ruin. So the parquet spun. The parquet is the Latin name for the three fates. In fear of this and holding in memory the old war she had carried on at Troy for Argus's sake, for Greece's sake, the origins of that anger, that suffering still rankled rankled deep within her, hidden away the judgment Paris gave, snubbing her loveliness, the race she hated, the honors given ravished Ganymede, Saturnian Juno burning for it all, buffeted on the waste of sea those Trojans left by the Greeks and pitiless Achilles, keeping them far from Latium. So they're in a big storm, and it's Juno's fault. She's keeping them buffeted on the sea. For years they wandered as their destiny drove them on from one sea to the next. So hard and huge a task it was to found the Roman people. So here, line 49, we see Virgil saying it was so hard and huge and terrible for them to found the Roman people, but we did it. Line 50. They were all under sail in open water, with Sicily just out of sight astern, so they can see the island of Sicily. You can follow this on a map. Light-hearted as they plowed the white-capped sea, with stern stems of cutting bronze, but never free of her, Juno, her eternal inward wound, and that is being the judgment of Paris, being turned down is not the most beautiful, the goddess said to herself, so this is Juno saying to herself, give up what I began? Am I defeated? Am I impotent to keep the king of the two Creons, the original Trojans, from Italy? The fates forbid me, am I to suppose? Could Pallas, and this would Palais, and this would be Minerva, Athena, as we know her in the Iliad and Odyssey, could Pallas then consume the Argive, the Greek fleet, with fire and drown the crews because of one man's mad act, the crime of Ajax, son of Oileus? She, yes, she, hurled out of cloudland lancing fire of Jove, scattered the ships, roughed up the sea with gales, then caught the man, bolt struck, exhaling flames. So Athena was able to grab the Ajax, the son of Oileus, for the atrocity he committed at the Trojan temple, and just impale him with a lightning bolt where he's exhaling flames, is the word picture we have here. Then caught the man, bolt struck, exhaling flames in a whirlwind, and impaled him on a rock. But I, who walk as queen of all the gods, sister and wife of Jove, I must contend for years against one people who adores the power of Juno after this, or lays an offering with prayer upon her altar. So Juno, Hera, is thinking, if I can't even ruin Aeneas, who will ever pray to me or make me offerings, because I'm basically impotent, I can't do anything. Smoldering, putting these questions to herself, the goddess made her way to storm cloud country, Aeolia, the weather-breeding isle. Here in a vast cavern, King Aeolus, the wind god, rules the contending winds and moaning gales as warden of their prison. So the wind gods are all trapped until you let one loose. Round the walls they chafe and bluster underground. The din makes a great mountain murmur overhead. High on a citadel enthroned, scepter in hand, he mollifies their fury. Else they might flay the sea and sweep away land masses and deep sky through empty air. So if they were not held bondage there, then they would go destroy everything. Line 85. In fear of this, Jupiter hid them away in caverns of black night. He set above them granite of high mountains, and a king empowered at command to rein them in or let them go. To this king Juno now made her petition. So Juno is requesting a petition to Jupiter, which of course is Hera and Zeus. Zeus, line 91, Aeolus, the father of gods and men, decreed and fixed your power to calm the waves or make them rise in wind. The race I hate is crossing the Tuscan sea, transporting Ilium, Troy, with her household gods, beaten as they are, to Italy. Put new fury into your winds and make the long ships founder. Drive them off course. Throw bodies in the sea. I have 14 exquisite nymphs, of whom the loveliest by far, Deiopia, shall be your own. I'll join you two in marriage, so she will spend all future years with you, as you so well deserve, and make you father of her lovely children. Said Aeolus, to settle on what you wish is all you need to do, your majesty. I must perform it. You have given me what realm I have. By your good offices I rule with Jove's consent. Zeus, and I recline among the gods at feasts, for you appoint me lord of wind and cloud. Spear half reversed, he gave the hollow mountainside a stroke, and where a portal opened, winds in ranks as though drawn up for battle, hurtled through to blow across the earth in hurricane, over the sea, tossed up from the seafloor, east wind and south wind, then the wild southwest with squall on squall, came scuttling down, rolling high combers shoreward. So there's a big storm coming. Now one heard the cries of men and screech of ropes in rigging suddenly as the storm cloud whipped away. Clear sky and daylight from the two Koreans, the Trojans, from their eyes, and gloom of night leaned on up the open sea. It thundered from all quarters as it lightened flash on flash through heaven. Every sign portented a quick death for mariners. Aeneas, this is the first use of Aeneas's name, here in Book 1, line 131. First use of his name. We've all just had to wonder who this hero was going to be. Aeneas, on the instant, what's the first thing he does? Felt his knees go numb and slack, and stretched both hands to heaven, groaning out. So the first thing he does in time of trouble is he invokes the gods and asks for help. Virgil is presenting Aeneas as a very religious, pious man. Triple lucky, all you men to whom death came before your father's eyes, below the wall at Troy. So everybody who died at Troy, you were really lucky. Look, we're going to die at sea, and nobody will ever find our bones and bury us. Bravest Danaan, the Greeks. Diomedes, why could I not go down when you had wounded me and lose my life on Ilium, Troy's battlefield? Our Hector lies there, torn by Achilles' weapon. There, Sarpedon, our giant fighter, lies. And there, the river Simois washes down so many shields and helmets with strong bodies taken under. As he, Aeneas, flung out these words, a howling gust from due north took the sail aback and lifted wavetops to heaven. Oars were snapped in two. The prow sheered round and left them broadside onto the breaking seas. Over her flank and deck, a mountain of gray water crashed in tons. Men hung on crests. To some, a yawning trough uncovered below, boiling waves and sand. The southwest wind caught three ships and whirled them down on reefs, hidden mid-sea, called by Italians the altars, razorbacks just under water. The east wind drove three others from deep water into great shoals and banks, embedding them and wringing them with sand, a desperate sight. Before Aeneas's eyes, a toppling billow struck the Lycian's ship, Orontes' ship, across the stern, pitching the steersman down and overboard. Three times, remember three is a magic number, three times the eddying sea carried the ship around in the same place under the rapid whirlpool, gulped it down. A few men swimming surfaced in the welter. So did shields, planks, precious things of Troy. Ilioneus's good ship, brave Achates' ship, the ship that carried Abas and the one Aletes sailed in, hale in his great age, were all undone by the wild gale. Their seams parted and let the enemy, the water, pour in. During all this, Neptune, Poseidon, became aware of hurly-burly and tempest overhead, bringing commotion to the still sea depth and rousing him. He lifted his calm brow above the surface, so Poseidon just looking above the water, viewing the great sea, and saw Aeneas's squadron far and wide dispersed over the water, saw the Trojans overwhelmed, the ruining clouds of heaven, and saw his angry sister's hand in all, Juno. He called to him eastward and south and said, this is Poseidon, are you so sure your line is privileged? How could you dare to throw heaven and earth into confusion by no will of mine and make such trouble? You will get from me, so this is Neptune, Poseidon, yelling at Aeolus, and he's going to say, you obey me. He's going to stop the storm right now. You will get from me, but first, to calm the rough sea. After this, you'll pay a stricter penalty for your sins. Off with you. Give this message to your king. So he's talking to the winds. Power over the sea and the cruel trident were never his by destiny, but mine. He owns the monstrous rocks, your home, east wind. Let Aeolus ruffle in that hall alone and lord it over winds shut in their prison. Before the words were out, he, Neptune Poseidon, quieted the surging water, drove the clouds away, and brought the sunlight back. Simothithe, this is a sea nymph, and Triton, this is the son of Neptune, walked side by side, or worked side by side to dislodge the grounded ships. So you can see them walking around with their tridents, undoing the grounded ships from the rocks. Then Neptune, with his trident, heaved them away, opened the miles of shoals, tempered the sea, and in his car, his chariot, departed, gliding over the wave-tops on light wheels. This is incredible imagery of Neptune riding a chariot over the waves with his trident. Now, a little bit of ring composition. When rioting breaks out in a great city, and the rampaging rabble goes so far that stones fly, and incendiary brands, so lit sticks, for anger can supply that kind of weapon. If it so happens, they look around and see some dedicated, a public man, a veteran whose record gives him weight. They quiet down, willing to stop and listen. Then he prevails in speech over their fury, by his authority and placates them. Just so, the whole uproar of the great sea fell silent, as the father of it all, father of the sea, Neptune, Poseidon, scanning horizons under the open sky, swung his team around and gave free rein in flight to his eager chariot. All right, so how did he calm the storm? This ring composition, not only is ring composition saying it was just like when there's the storm on the sea, which Poseidon, Neptune calmed, is just like when a riot breaks out in a city and some wonderful public man steps up, says some good words, and they quiet down. And of course, who is this dedicated public man mentioned here in Book 1, line 206? That's Augustus Caesar. He's being hinted at right here in line 206. Tired out, now we go back to the storm has just ended. Tired out, Aeneas's people made for the nearest land, which is going to be North Africa, Carthage. Turning their prows toward Libya, there's a spot where at the mouth of a long bay, an island makes a harbor forming a breakwater, where every swell divides as it comes in and runs far into curving recesses. There are high cliffs on this side and on that, and twin peaks towering heavenward impend on reaches of still water. Over these, against a forest backdrop shimmering, a dark and shaggy grove casts a deep shade, while in the cliffside opposite, below the overhanging peaks, there is a cave with fresh water and seats in the living rock, the home of nymphs. Here never an anchor chain, never an anchor's biting fluke, need hold a tired ship. Aeneas put in here with only 7 ships from his full number, and longing for the firm earth underfoot, so he's lost all his ships except 7. The Trojans disembarked to take possession of the desired sand beach. Down they lay to rest their brine-soaked bodies on the shore. Achates promptly struck a fire from flint and caught it in the dry leaves. He added tinder round about and waved it for a flame burst. Then they brought out the grains of Ceres. Ceres is the goddess of grain, before we get our word cereal. They brought out the grain of Ceres, tainted by seawater, and Ceres's implements, and weary of their troubles, made all ready to dry and grind with millstones what they had. Meanwhile, Aeneas climbed one of the peaks for a long seaward view, hoping to sight gale-worn Antheus, this is Trojan leader, and the Phrygian Biremes, the Trojan ships. Capys, this is one of the Trojan kings of Albalanga, or high poops bearing Caicus's arms, other Trojans. He found no ship in sight, but on the shore 3 wandering stags. Behind them, whole herds followed, grazing in a long line down the valleys, planting his feet. He took in hand the bow and arrows carried by his aide Achates. Then, aiming for the leaders with heads high and branching antlers, brought them first to earth. So he shoots a couple of stags. Next, he routed the whole herd, driving them with his shafts through leafy places, shooting and shooting till he won the hunt by laying 7 carcasses on the ground, a number equal to his ships. Then back to port he went and parceled out the game to his ship's companies. So he got 7 stags, and he has 7 ships left. There he divided the wine courtly Acestes had poured out and given them on the Sicilian shore. So the king of Sicily has given them wine, and they're pouring that full jugs of it when they were about to sail. By this and a simple speech, Aeneas comforted his people. So they have these stags and they have wine that the king of Sicily gave them. And line 270, this is Aeneas giving a speech to the remaining 7 ships worth of people. Friends and companions, have we not known hard hours before this? My men, who have endured still greater dangers, God will grant us an end to these as well. You sailed by Scylla's rage, her booming crags, you saw the Cyclops, boulders. He's invoking everything that Odysseus experienced in the Odyssey. Now call back your courage and have done with fear and sorrow. Someday, perhaps, remembering even this will be a pleasure. Through diversities of luck and through so many challenges, we hold our course for Latium, where the fates hold out a settlement and rest for us. Troy's kingdom there shall rise again. So here, book one, lines 280, 81, and 82 is telling us Rome is going to be the new Troy. Be patient. Save yourselves for more auspicious days. So ran the speech. Burdened and sick at heart, he faked, hope in his look and inwardly contained his anguish. So he's putting up a good front. Now the Trojan crews made ready for their windfall and their feast. They skinned the deer, bared ribs and viscera, then one lot sliced the flesh and skewered it on spits, so they're having a barbecue, all quivering while others filled bronze cooking pots and tended the beach fires. All got their strength back from the meal, reclining on the wild grass, gorging on venison and mellowed wine. When hunger had been banished and tables put away, they talked at length in hope and fear about their missing friends. Could one believe they might still be alive, or had they suffered their last hour? Never again to hear a voice that called them. Aeneas, more than any, secretly mourned for them all. For that fierce man, Orontes, one of the Lycian leaders, then for Amycus, so he's secretly mourning for all the men he's lost of the ships. Then for the bitter fate of Lysis, for brave Gaius and brave Cloanthus, he's mourning all the leaders. It was the day's end when from highest air Jupiter, Zeus, looked down on the broad sea, flecked with wings of sails on the land masses, coasts and nations of the earth. He stood on heaven's height, upon Mount Olympus probably, and turned his gaze toward Libya. And as he took the troubles there to heart, Venus, Aphrodite, the mother of Aeneas, appealed to him, all pale and wan, with tears in her shining eyes. So Venus, Aphrodite, is all worried about her son Aeneas, who Juno tried to drown. And it appears that Zeus has been busy or napping or something all day. He's just now noticing what was going on. So Aphrodite, Venus, says to her father, "My lord, who rule the lives of men and gods now and forever, and bring them all to heel with your bright bolt, what in the world could my Aeneas do? What could the Trojans do so to offend you, that after suffering all those deaths, they find the whole world closed to them because of Italy? Surely from these the Romans are to come, in the course of years renewing Teucer's line, the original Trojans, to rule the sea and all the lands about it, according to your promise. What new thought has turned you from them, father?" So again, she is just confirming that the Romans, that these Trojans are going to become the new Romans, as though this is prophetic, looking back 1,000 years forward. "What new thought has turned you from them, father? I consoled myself for Troy's fall, that grim ruin, weighing out one fate against another in the scales. But now, when they have borne so many blows, the same misfortune follows them. Great king, what finish to their troubles will you give? After Antenor," and this is a Trojan founder of what would be modern Padua, "after Antenor slipped through the Achaeans, he could explore Illyrian coves and reach in safety the Liburnians," and these are people off the Adriatic Sea, "in island kingdoms and the source of the Tamaris, through 9 openings with a great rumble in the mountain wall. It bursts from the ground there and floods the fields in a rushing sea. And yet he chose that place for Padua and new homes for the Teucrians, gave them a name, set up the arms of Troy, and now rests in his peace. As for ourselves, your own children, whom you make heirs of heaven, our ships being lost, oh, this is unspeakable, we are forsaken through one enemy's raid," and, of course, talking about her mother, Hera, "and kept remote from Italy. Is this the palm for loyalty? This our power restored?" Her stepmother, I suppose she is. He smiled at her, Zeus, the father of gods and men, with that serenity that calms the weather, and lightly kissed his daughter. Then he said, so this is Zeus speaking to Venus Aphrodite, "No need to be afraid, Cythera." Remember, Cythera is one of the nicknames for Aphrodite because they worshipped her on Cythera. "So no need to be afraid, Cythera," Venus Aphrodite. "Your children's destiny has not been changed. As promised, you shall see Lavinium's walls." This is going to be the Italian Trojan settlement. "You shall see Lavinium's walls and take them up then amid the stars of heaven, great souled Aeneas. No new thought has turned me. No, he, your son. Now let me speak of him. In view of your consuming care at length, unfolding secret, fated things to come, in Italy he will fight a massive war, beat down fierce armies, then for the people there establish city walls and a way of life. When the Rutulians, these are the Latians who are ruled by Turnus, who is fated to die, when the Rutulians are subdued, he'll pass 3 summers of command in Latium, 3 years of winter quarters, but the boy, Ascanius, so Aeneas' son, to whom the name of Iulius now is added. So Ascanius' other name is Iulius, and this would be Julius, the same as Julius Caesar, Augustus Caesar's adopted father or uncle. Now is added Illus, while Ilium stood, will hold the power for all of 30 years, great rings of wheeling months. He will transfer his capital from Lavinium and make a fortress, Alba Longa. And of course, Virgil is reciting history. This is how it kind of actually does come down, but they're presenting it as though it's 1,000 years early as prophecy. 3 full centuries that kingdom will be ruled by Hector's race, until the queen and priestess Ilia, and that is Rhea Silvia, pregnant by Mars, will bear 2 sons to him. And this, of course, is going to be Romulus and Remus, who are set out to put in a basket, and they flow up the Tiber River and will end up in a special cave, and a she-wolf will nurse them, and then eventually Romulus will rise up and kill Remus, and that's why Rome is called Rome, not Reme. Okay? Until the queen and priestess, Ilia, Rhea Silvia, pregnant by Mars, will bear bear 2 sons to him. Afterward, happy in the tawny pelt, his nurse, the she-wolf, wears, young Romulus will take the leadership, build walls of Mars, Ares Hill, and call by his own name his people Romans, after Romulus. For these I set no limits, world or time, but make the gift of empire without end. So here, Book 1, line 375, we learn, if it was told 1000 BC, which is how Virgil presents it, Rome is just meant to rule. The gift of empire without end is what he's giving them. Juno, indeed, whose bitterness now fills with fear the torment sea and earth and sky, will mend her ways and favor them as I do, lords of the world, the toga-bearing Romans. Such is our pleasure. As the years fall away and age comes, when Asarchius's royal house, the grandfather of Aeneas, when his royal house will bring to servitude the Thessalian Pythia, renowned Mycenae too, and subjugate defeated Argus. From that comely line, the Trojan Caesar comes to circumscribe empire with ocean, fame with heavens, stars, Julius his name, from Iulius handed down. So here is the first mention of Julius Caesar. All tranquil shall you take him heavenward in time, laden with plunder of the east, line 390. And he with you shall be invoked in prayer. Wars at an end, harsh centuries then will soften. Ancient Fides and Vesta, Quirinus and brother Remus will be lawgivers, and grim with iron frames, the gates of war will then be shut. Inside, unholy furor. Okay, here's the first mention of the gates of war. They're going to be shut. And this is referring to that Pax Romana, the Roman peace. The Romans ruled with such an iron fist that they did create a peace around their empire. The gates of war will then be shut inside unholy furor, or furor impious, non-religious wrath. This Roman peace is given as a cosmic event, not just a political achievement, but as though it's fated for the Romans to bring peace to perhaps all the entire world. The gates of war will then be shut inside unholy furor, squatting on cruel weapons, hands enchained behind him by 100 links of bronze, will grind his teeth and howl with bloodied mouth. So furor being presented here metamorphically as a god or goddess, furor will be just locked up. The Romans will just lock up the fury of war. That said, he sent the son of Maia. Who's the son of Maia? Hermes. This is the daughter of Atlas, the mother of Hermes, the son of Maia, he's the messenger god, down from his high place to make the land of Carthage, the new built town, receptive to the Trojans, not to allow Queen Dido, all unknowing as to the fated future, to exclude them. So poor Queen Dido, he sent a messenger down so that Dido will be favorable to these new guests who have recently landed on her shores, because she does not know. She's all unknowing as to the fated future. She's all unknowing that Aeneas is going to use her and that the Romans will destroy Carthage later in future. So Dido is all unknowing, but Hermes is coming down to grant them favor. So not to allow Queen Dido, all unknowing as to the fated future, to exclude them. Through the vast air, with stroking wings, he flew and came down quickly to the Libyan coast, performing Jove's command, so that at once Phoenicians put aside belligerence as the god willed. Especially the queen took on a peaceful mood and open mind toward Teucrians, the Trojans. But the dedicated man Aeneas, thoughtful through the restless night, made up his mind, as kindly daylight came, to go out and explore the strange new places, to learn what coast the wind had brought him to, and who were living there, men or wild creatures, for wilderness was all he saw, and bring report back to his company. So when they almost crashed the day before, while everyone else was recovering from almost dying, first he went out and hunted and got 7 stags for all his men and encouraged them and all, and now the next morning, while everyone is still sleeping, he's out to check out the land and see if this is a safe place for them to be. So Aeneas is being presented completely as the ultimate hero. For wilderness was all he saw, and bring report back to his company. The ships he hid beneath a hollowed rocky cliff, and groves that made a vault, trees all around, in deep shade quivering. So the ships are where you can't find them easily. He took his way with only one man at his side, Achates, hefting 2 hunting spears with broad steel points. Then, suddenly in front of him, his mother, Aeneas' mother Venus, his mother crossed his path in mid-forest, wearing a girl's shape and a girl's gear, a Spartan girl, or like that one of Thrace, Harpalyce, so a warrior girl, who tires horses out, outrunning the swift Hebrus. She had hung about her shoulders the light, handy bow a huntress carries, and had given her hair to disheveling wind, so her hair has been all blown all over. Her knees were bare, her flowing gown knotted and curdled up, and she spoke first. So this is Venus Aphrodite speaking to her son Aeneas. "Ho, young fellows, have you seen, can you say where, one of my sisters here, in a spotted lynx hide, belted with a quiver, scouting the wood, or shouting on the track behind a flome-fecked boar?" To Venus, then, the son of Venus answered, "No, I've heard or seen none of your sisters. Only, how shall I address you, girl? Your looks not mortal, neither has your accent a mortal ring. O goddess, beyond doubt, Apollo's sister, one of the family of nymphs, so, you know, are you Apollo's sister Artemis? Be kind, whoever you may be, to relieve our trouble. Tell us under what heaven we've come at last, on what shore of the world we are cast up, wanderers that we are, strange to this country, driven here by wind and heavy sea. By my right hand many an offering will be cut down for you before your altars." Again, Aeneas being very pious. Venus replied, line 455, "Be sure I am not fit for any such devotion. Tyrian girls are given to wearing quivers and hunting boots of crimson, laced up to the leg, up to the knee. This is the Punic Carthage kingdom that you see. The folks are Tyrian, the town Agnors, but neighboring lands belong to Libya, a nation hard to fight against in war. The ruler here is Dido of Tyre city." So Dido came from Tyre. Think of Tyre and Sidon in the New Testament, Tyre and Sidon. "The ruler here is Dido of Tyre city, in flight here from her brother." So she had to run away from her brother. "A long tale of wrong endured, mysterious and long. But let me tell the main events in order. Her husband was Sychaeus." So here we learn that Dido had a husband, Sychaeus. Dido's now a widow. "All of Phoenicians, richest in land, and greatly loved by her, ill-fated woman." Anytime they talk about Dido, it's poor Dido, ill-fated woman, unlucky Dido. That's just her lot in this story. Line 470. "Her father had given her a virgin still in marriage, her first right. Her brother, though, held power in Tyre, Pygmalion." And you can look up Pygmalion. That's her brother who does bad things. "A monster of wickedness beyond all others. Between the two men, furious hate arose." So between her husband Sychaeus and her brother Pygmalion. "And sacrilegiously before the altars, driven by a blind lust for gold, Pygmalion," her evil brother, "took Sychaeus," her husband by surprise and killed him with a dagger blow in secret. So Dido's brother killed her husband. Undeterred by any thought of Dido's love, he hid what he had done for a long time, causing her, deluding the sick woman with false hope. But the true form of her unburied husband came in a dream. So her husband's shade appears to her, and he's not buried. And remember how important it is to be buried. But the true form of her unburied husband came in a dream, lifting his pallid, pale face before her. Strangely, he made visible the cruel altars, and his body pierced, uncovering all the dark crime of the house. He urged her then to make haste and take flight, run away, leaving her fatherland, and to assist the journey, revealed a buried treasure of old time, unknown to any, a weight of gold and silver. Impelled by this, Dido laid her plans to get away and to equip her company, so she's going to run away from her brother. All who hated the tyrant, all in fear as bitter as her own, now came together, and ships in port, already fitted out, they commandeered to fill with gold the riches Pygmalion had itched for, went to sea. So Pygmalion killed her husband Sychaeus to get all the treasure, but now her dead husband came to her in a vision and told her where all the treasure was, and she took it, put it in ships, and left. Pygmalion had itched for, it all went to sea, and captaining the venture was a woman. They sailed to this place where today you'll see some walls going hither in the citadel of Carthage, the new town. So this is all her mother telling her all the history. This is Aeneas's mother telling him the complete history of Dido, and that she's widowed, that her brother killed her husband, and how she got here and how she's building a city. Her mother is making sure that his mother is making sure Aeneas has the whole scoop. Back to line 501. The new town. They bought the land, called Drumskin, from the bargain made, a tract they could enclose with one bull's hide. And this is a famous legend of Dido. She could have all of the land she could enclose with a bull's hide. And so rather than, and a bull's hide isn't very big, but she had it lanced into one tiny, long strand going around and around and around the edge, and was able to get plenty of land, lots of land. But now, says his mother to him, what of yourselves? From what coast do you come? Where are you bound? Pretending to not know it's her son Aeneas. Then to the questioner, which is Venus, he answered, sighing, bringing out the words from deep within him. Line 510. Goddess, if I should tell our story from the start, if you had leisure to hear our annals of adversity, before I finished, the fair evening star would come to close Olympus on the day. It would take forever. It's too long of a story. Line 515. From old Troy, if the name of Troy has fallen perhaps upon your own ears, if you've ever heard of Troy, we sailed the seas, and yesterday were driven by a storm of its own whim upon this Libyan coast. I am Aeneas, duty-bound and known above high heir of heaven by my fame, carrying with me in my ships our gods of hearth and home, saved from the enemy. I looked for Italy to be my fatherland, and my descent is from all highest Jove. With 20 ships I mounted the Phrygian sea, as my immortal mother, and that's who he's talking to, showed the way. I followed the given fates. Now barely 7 ships are left, battered by wind and sea. So he left with 20 ships, and he now has 7. And I myself, unknown and unprovisioned, crossed the Libyan wilderness, an exile driven from Europe and from Asia, because Troy is Asia. But Venus chose to hear no more complaints from her son, and broke in midway through his bitterness. Whoever you are, and of course this is Venus to Aeneas, her son, she pretends she doesn't know him. Whoever you are, I doubt heaven is unfriendly to you, as you still breathe life-giving air on your approach to the Tyrian town. Go on, betake yourself this way to the queen's gate. Your friends are back. This is my news for you. Your ships were saved and brought to shore again by winds shifting north. So he still has 7 ships. Or else my parents taught me augury to no purpose. Look, see the 12 swans in line rejoicing there? Jove's eagle, like a bolt out of the blue, had flurried them in open ocean. But now they seem to be alighting one by one, or looking down on those already grounded. As they disport themselves with flapping wings after their chanting flight above the sky, just so your ships and your ships' companies are either in port or entering under sail. So he's getting the ships back. Go on then, where the path leads. Go ahead. On this, she turned away. Rose pink and fair her nape, the back of her neck, shone. Her ambrosial hair exhaled divine perfume. Her gown rippled full length, and by her stride she showed herself a goddess. Knowing this for his mother, he called out to the figure, fleeting away, "You cruel two! Why tease your son so often with disguises? Why may not we join hands and speak and hear the simple truth?" So he called after her and went on toward the town. But Venus muffled the two wayfarers in gray mist. A cloak of dense cloud poured about them, so they're invisible, basically, so that no one had the power to see or to accost them, make them halt, or ask them what they came for. Away to Paphos, through high air she went in joy, to see her home again. So she's going to Paphos is the seat of Venus's worship in Cyprus, and that's where she's going. To see her home again, her shrine and 100 altars, where Sabacan incense fumed and garlands freshened the air. Meanwhile, the two men pressed on where the pathway led, and Venus has enshrouded them in a mist so that no one will see them or accost them. Soon climbing a long ridge that gave a view down over the city and facing towers, Aeneas found where lately huts had been, marvelous buildings, gateways, cobbled ways and din of wagons. There the Tyrians were hard at work, laying courses for walls, rolling up stones to build the citadel, while others picked out building sites and plowed a boundary furrow. Laws were being enacted, magistrates and a sacred senate chosen. Here men were dredging harbors. There they laid the deep foundation of a theater, line 586, and quarried massive pillars to enhance the future stage. As bees, what were they like? All these people working, creating a city, working everywhere. Here's a simile. What was it like? As bees in early summer in sunlight in the flowering fields hum at their work and bring along the young full grown to beehood, as they cram their combs with honey, brimming all the cells with nectar, or take newcomers' plunder, or like troops all alerted drive away the lazy drones, and labor thrives and sweet thyme scents the honey. So it's just like that. Aeneas said, "How fortunate these are, whose city walls are rising here and now." So they're just like busy bees. He looked up at the roofs, for he had entered, swathed in cloud, strange to relate among them, mingling with men, yet visible to none. In midtown, line 600, a grove that cast sweet shade, where the Phoenicians, shaken by wind and sea, had first dug up that symbol Juno showed them, a proud war horse's head. This meant for Carthage prowess in war and ease of life through ages. Here being built by the Sidonian queen, that's Dido, was a great temple planned in Juno's honor. Okay, so this temple they're building is going to be for Juno. That's the goddess, actually, who hates them, which is rather ironic that they're planning a temple for Juno and she hates him. Rich in offerings and the godhead there, steps led up to a sill of bronze with brazen lintel and bronze doors on groaning pins. Here in this grove, new things that met his eyes calmed Aeneas's fear for the first time. Here for the first time he took a heart to hope for safety and to trust his destiny more even in affliction. It was while he walked from one to another wall of the great temple and waited for the queen, a staring amazed at Carthaginian promise, at the handiwork of artificers and the toil they spent upon it, he found before his eyes the Trojan battles in the old war, now known throughout the world, the great Atreidae, Agamemnon and Menelaus, Priam and Achilles, fierce in his rage at both sides. Here Aeneas halted, and tears came. So he's seen artwork on the walls of this city that show the Trojan War. So he realized they know all about the Trojan War. And he says, "What spot on earth," he said, "what region of earth, Achates, his friend, is not full of the story of our sorrow? Look, here's Priam. Even so far away, great valor has due honor. They weep here for how the world goes." So he's realizing, oh my goodness, they will be honoring me as a Trojan refugee. He realizes, okay, they're presenting his side. "And our life that passes touches their hearts. Throw off your fear. This fame ensures some kind of refuge. They're going to be friendly to us here." He broke off to feast his eyes and mind on a mere image, sighing often, cheeks grown wet with tears, to see again how, fighting around Troy, the Greeks broke here and ran before the Trojans, and there the Phrygians ran as plumed Achilles harried them in his war car. Nearby then he recognized the snowy canvas tents of Rhesus, the guy whose horses Odysseus stole in Book 10 of the Iliad. And more tears came. These, betrayed of first sleep, Diomedes, devastated, sworded many, till he wrecked with blood. That's talking about Iliad chapter 10. And turned the mettlesome horses toward the beachhead before they tasted Trojan grass or drank at Xanthus's ford. So there's even a portrait of Rhesus and all of his horses, with all the men being slain before they could fight, and the horses all being taken over to the Greeks before they could even eat any Trojan grass. Line 646. And on another panel, Troilus, without his armor, luckless boy, no match for his antagonist, Achilles, appeared pulled outward by his team. He clung to his war car, though fallen backward, hanging onto the reins still, head dragged on the ground, his javelin scribbling S's in the dust. Meanwhile, to hostile palaces, Athena's shrine, the Trojan women walked with hair unbound, because they're begging Pallas Athena to spare them, and so they're walking around her shrine with their hair undone. It's kind of a sign of mourning. Bearing the robe of offering, and they even took her a new robe, in sorrow, entreating her, beating their breasts, but she, her face averted, so Athena won't even look at them, Minerva, would not raise her eyes. And there was Hector dragged around Troy walls 3 times, and there for gold Achilles sold him, bloodless and lifeless. Now indeed Aeneas heaved a mighty sigh from deep within him, seeing the spoils, the chariot, and the corpse of his great friend Hector, and Priam, all unarmed, stretching his hands out. Line 665. He himself he saw in combat with the first of the Achaeans. That would be the king of the Ethiopians, the allies of the Trojans, the one he fought with first. And saw the ranks of Dawn, black Memnon's arms, then leading the battalion of Amazons with half-moon shields. He saw Penthesilea, that's the Amazon queen, fiery amid her host, buckling a golden girdle beneath her bare and arrogant breast, a girl who dared fight men, a warrior queen. Now, while these wonders were being surveyed by Aeneas of Dardania, Troy, while he stood enthralled, devouring all in one long gaze, the queen, that's Dido, paced toward the temple in her beauty, Dido with a throng of men behind. And what was it like when Dido comes? As on Eurotas' bank or Cynthus' ridge, Diana, Artemis, trains her dances, and behind her, on every hand, the mountain nymphs appear, a Myriad converging with her quiver slung on her shoulders in her stride. She seems the tallest, taller by a head than any, and joy pervades Latona's quiet heart. The Greek Leto, the mom of Apollo and Diana, and pervades Leto, Latona's quiet heart. So Dido seemed. So she looked just like Leto, the mother of Apollo and Diana. In such delight she moved amid her people, cheering on the toil of a kingdom in the making. At the door of the goddess's shrine, under the temple dome, all hedged about with guards, on her high throne she took her seat. Then she began to give them judgments and rulings, so Dido's doing her daily work, to apportion work with fairness, or assign some task by lot, when suddenly Aeneas saw approaching, accompanied by a crowd, Antheus and Sergestus and brave Cloanthus, with a few companions whom the black hurricane had driven far over the sea and brought to other coasts. He was astounded, and Achates too felt thrilled by joy and fear. Both of them longed to take their friends' hands, but uncertainty hampered them, so they're seeing friends they thought were drowned. So, in their cloudy mantle, they hid their eagerness, waiting to learn what luck these men had, where on the coast they left their ships, and why they came. It seemed spokesmen for all the ships were now arriving, entering the hall, calling for leave to speak. When all were in, and full permission given to make their plea before the queen, their eldest, Ilancus, with composure said, so this is the first of the captain of the ships, and Aeneas is waiting to see what happens to him, instead of speaking first. So he says to Dido, "Your Majesty, granted by great Jupiter freedom to found your new town here and govern fighting tribes with justice, we poor Trojans, worn by winds on every sea, entreat you. Keep away calamity of fire from our ships. Let a God-fearing people live and look more closely at our troubles, not to ravage Libyan hearths or turn with plunder seaward have we come, and that force and that audacity are not for beaten men. So please don't burn our ships down and kill all of us. We're all beaten up. We're not here to take over. We just need some shelter. There is a country called by the Greeks Hesperia, and of course that's the western land, Italy. The Greeks Hesperia, very old, potent in warfare and in wealth of earth, Antrians, framed it, these are southern Italians, younger settlers now, the tale goes, call it by their chief's name, Italy. We laid our course for this, but stormy Orion. So Orion setting in the fall precedes the stormy season. And so they say by stormy Orion because that that came first before the storm. And a high sea rising deflected us on shoals and drove us far with winds against us into whelming waters, unchanneled reefs. We kept afloat, we few, to reach your coast. What race of man is this? What primitive state could sanction this behavior? Even on beaches we are denied a landing, harried by outcry and attack, forbidden to set foot on the outskirts of your country. If you care nothing for humanity and merely mortal arms, respect the gods who are mindful of good actions and of evil. So they're requesting Xenia, hospitality. This is the code of hospitality being invoked. Have respect for the gods, because they're mindful of good actions. The gods will notice if you don't give us Xenia. We had a king, Aeneas. See, they think he's dead. None more just, more zealous, greater in warfare and in arms. And of course, he's standing there listening, invisibly. If fate preserves him, if he does not yet lie spent amidst the insensible shades, but still takes nourishment of air, we need fear nothing. If Aeneas is still alive, we'll be fine. Neither need you repent of being first in courtesy to outdo us. Sicily, too, has towns and ploughlands and a famous king of Trojan blood, Acestes. And, of course, this is a king of Sicily who's a friend to Trojans, too. And may we be permitted here to beach our damaged ships, have timbers, hew timbers from your forest, cut new oars, and either sail again for Latium, for Italy, happily, if we recover shipmates and our king, or else, if that security is lost, if Libyan waters hold you, Lord Aeneas, best of Trojans, you know, if you're drowned, best of Trojans, Aeneas. Hope of Ilius gone, we may at least cross over to Sicily from where we came, to homesteads ready there, and take Acestus for our king. Aeneas finished, and all the sons of Dardanus murmured assent. Yeah, that's what we want to do. If Aeneas is dead, we'll just go on to Sicily. We know people there. They'll take care of us. If he's not dead, we're just going to sail for Italy. Please don't attack us. So Aeneas finished, and all the sons of Dardanus, line 760, murmured assent. Dido, with eyes downcast, replied in a brief speech, "Cast off your fear, you Teucrians. Put anxiety aside. Severe conditions and the kingdom's youth constrain me to these measures to protect our long frontiers with guards. Who has not heard of the people of Aeneas, of Troy's city, her valors and her heroes, and the fires of the great war? We are not so oblivious, we Phoenicians. The sun yokes his team within our range at Carthage. Whether you choose Hesperia Magna and the land of Saturn or Eryx in the west and King Acestes, I shall dispatch you safely with an escort, provisioned from my stores. Or would you care to join us in this realm on equal terms? The city I build is yours. Haul up your ships. Trojan and Tyrian will be all one to me. If only he were here, your king himself," and of course he is there, "caught by the same easterly Aeneas. Indeed, let me send out trustworthy men along the coast with orders to comb it all from one end of Libya to the other, in case the sea cast up the man and now he wanders lost in town or wilderness." Elated at Dido's words, both staunch Achates and Father Aeneas, who they're calling Father Aeneas now, had by this time longed to break out of the cloud. Achates spoke with urgency, "My lord, born to the goddess, what do you feel? What is your judgment now? You see all safe, and our ships and friends recovered. One is lost. We saw that one go down ourselves amid the waves. Everything else bears out your mother's own account of it. I think what your mother told you, you're the goddess who disguised herself as a young maiden, I think she's right. Your ships really were all saved." He barely finished when the cloud around them parted suddenly and thinned away into transparent air. So now they're visible. Princely Aeneas stood and shone in the bright light, head and shoulders, noble as a god's. So Venus is beautifying Aeneas. For she who bore him breathed upon him beauty of hair and bloom of youth and kindled brilliance in his eyes, as an artist's hand gives style to ivory. So she's really beautified him, washed his hair, you know, added a little product to his hair and makes him look gorgeous and handsome and all that. Line 805, Orsett's pure silver or white stone of Paris in framing yellow gold. Then to the queen he spoke as suddenly as to them all he had just appeared. So out of nowhere, Aeneas just appears and says, before your eyes I stand. Line 810, Aeneas the Trojan, that same one you look for, saved from the sea off Libya. You alone, moved by the untold ordeals of old Troy, seen us few whom the Greeks left alive, worn out by faring ill on land and sea, needy of everything, you'd give these few a home and city, allied with yourselves. Fit thanks for this are not within our power, not to be had from Trojans anywhere dispersed in the great world. We could never thank you enough. May the gods, and surely there are powers that care for goodness, surely somewhere justice counts, may they and your own consciousness of acting well reward you as they should. What age so happy brought you to birth? How splendid were your parents to have conceived a being like yourself? So he's praising the queen. So long as brooks flow seaward and the shadows play over mountain slopes and highest heaven feeds the stars, your name, which is Dido, and your distinction go with me, whatever lands may call me. So Aeneas says to her, wherever I go, I'll talk about you and how awesome you are. With this, he gave his right hand to his friend Ilioneus, greeting Serestus with his left, then took the hands of those brave men, Cloanthus, Gaius, and the rest. So he's shaking hands with all the guys he thought were dead. Sidonian Dido stood in astonishment, first at the sight of such a captain, then at his misfortune. So first she thinks, oh my goodness, he's so good looking, and then she just can't believe all he's gone through. Presently saying, line 840, born of an immortal mother though you are, what adverse destiny dogs you through these many kinds of danger? What rough power brings you from sea to land in savage places? Are you truly he, Aeneas, whom kind Venus bore to the Dardanian, the young Anchises, near to the stream of Phrygian Simois? I remember the Greek Teucer came to Sidon, exiled and in search of a new kingdom. Belus, my father, helped him. In those days, Belus campaigned with fire and sword on Cyprus and won that island's wealth. Since then, the fall of Troy, your name, and the Pelasgian kings have been familiar to me. Teucer, your enemy, spoke often with admiration of the Teucrians and traced his own descent from Teucrian stock. Come then, soldiers, be our guests. My life was one of hardship and forced wandering like your own, till in this land at length fortune would have me rest. Through pain I've learned to comfort suffering men. She, Dido, led Aeneas into the royal house, but not before declaring a festal day in the gods' temples. So they're going to have a holiday. As for the ship's companies, line 865, she sent 20 bulls to the shore, 100 swine, huge ones with bristling backs, and fatted lambs, 100 of them, and their mother ewes, all gifts for happy feasting on that day. Now the queen's household made her great hall glow as they prepared a banquet in the kitchens. Embroidered tablecloths, proud crimson dyed, were spread, and of course crimson dye is extremely expensive, and set with massive silver plate or gold engraved with brave deeds of her fathers, a sequence carried down through many captains in a long line from the founding of the race. Meanwhile, paternal love would not allow Aeneas's mind to rest. So he has this fatherly love. He sent Achates on a quick mission to the ships to tell Ascanius and to bring him to the city. Fond father, as always thoughtful of his son. So the first thing he thinks of when it's very safe is, oh, go get Ascanius. I can't leave him down by the ships wondering what happened to me. He told Achates to fetch gifts as well, relics of Ilium of Troy, a robe stiff with figures worked in gold, and a veil woven round with yellow acanthus flowers, both adornments worn by Argive Helen when she sailed for Pergamum and her forbidden marriage, marvelous keepsakes of her mother Leda, along with these a sceptered Ilani, eldest of Priam's daughters, once had used, a collar hung with pearls, and a coronet doubled in gems and gold. Given these orders, Achates lost no time seeking the ships. So Achates goes back to get Ascanius, Aeneas' son, and to get a whole bunch of really cool gifts to give to the queen. Our Lady of Cythera, line 895, and of course this is Venus, however, and that's where she was born, Cythera. Our Lady of Cythera, Venus Aphrodite, however, pondered new interventions, a new strategy, that her young godly son, Desire, who is we call Cupid, her son Cupid, should take the face and figure of Ascanius. So she's going to make her son Cupid look like Ascanius. then come and use his gifts. What are Cupid's gifts? Making people fall in love. Then come and use his gifts to make the queen infatuated, inflaming her with lust to the marrow of her bones. Venus no doubt lacked faith in the ambiguous royal house and Tyrion's double-dealing. Then the spite of Juno vexed her. Her anxieties recurred as night came on. So she addressed him, Amor, god of the caressing wings. And, of course, this is desire, Cupid. My son, my strength, my greatest power, my one and only, making light of our high father's bolt, his giant killer, I must turn to you and beg the force of your divinity. You know how brother Aeneas has been tossed from one coast to another on the high seas by bitter Juno's hatred. You know this, and in my grieving for him, grieve as well. Now, the Phoenician woman Dido has him, making him linger with her blandishments, and what may come of this Junonian welcome worries me seriously. Juno will act at such a crisis of affairs. Accordingly, what I propose is to ensnare the queen, Dido, by guile beforehand, pin her down in passion, so she cannot be changed by any power, but will be kept on my side by profound love of Aeneas. So Venus is going to make Dido love Aeneas so that Juno can't make her dislike him. So they're playing. The gods are playing with Dido and Aeneas just because of the hatred that Venus has for Juno. Line 9-5. Take heed of our thought how you may do this. The boy prince, my greatest care in the world, must now go to the city, summoned by his father. So Ascanius going to his father, taking gifts saved from the great sea and the fires of Troy. I'll drug him in his sleep, then hide him well, high up on Cythera, or on Cyprus, over Idalium in my shrine. There is no way for him to learn this trick or interfere. You counterfeit his figure for one night. So Cupid's supposed to disguise himself as Ascanius for one night. No more, and make the boy known face your mask, so look just like him, so that when Dido takes you on her lap amid the banqueting and wine in joy, when she embraces you and kisses you, you'll breathe invisible fire into her and dupe her with your sorcery. Amor, Cupid, agreed with his fond mother's plan of action, put off his wings, and gaily walked as Aeolus, or Ascanius, the son of Aeneas. Venus, in turn, sent through Ascanius's body rills of slumber, caught him to her breast, and bore him to Idalia's aerial groves, where beds of marjoram embraced him in soft bloom and breathing shade. So the real Ascanius, Aeolus, is just going to go take a long one-day nap. Soon then the godling, doing as she wished, happily followed where Achates led, carried the royal gifts to the Tyrians. He found the queen amid magnificence of tapestries, where she had placed herself in the very center on a golden couch. Then Father Aeneas and the Trojan company came in to take their ease on crimson cloth. Houseboys filled their finger bowls and brought them bread in baskets, napkins, nubbled smooth. In the great kitchen there were 50 maids to set the dishes out in a long line and tend the fires that shone for the hearth gods. 100 others, and as many boys of the same age, loaded the boards with meat and placed the wine cups. Tyrians as well came crowding through the radiant doors, line 965, all bidden to take their ease on figured cushioning. There they admired Aeneas's gifts, admired Aeolus, who's really Cupid in disguise, with his godling's face aglow and simulated speech. He sounds and looks like Ascanius, Aeolus. Then the great robe, the veil that yellow acanthus flowers edged, all the presents he brought from Troy, Helen's clothing, and more than anyone, the Phoenician queen, luckless, already given over to ruin, marveled and could not have enough. She burned with pleasure in the boy and in the gifts. After hugging Aeneas around the neck and clinging to him, answering the love of the deluded father, he sought the queen. So Cupid, disguised as Ascanius, hugs his father, convinces him, then goes to the queen, and she, with all her eyes and heart, embraced him, little Ascanius, who's really Cupid in disguise, folding him at times upon her breast, oblivious of how great a god sat there but to her undoing, oblivious that she has Cupid sitting on her lap. Mindful of his mother, so Cupid, disguised as Aeneas' son, is going to make Dido completely forget her husband Sychaeus, who she's in mourning for, and make him love Aeneas. So mindful of his mother, he had begun to make Sychaeus fade from Dido's memory. So Dido, whose husband was murdered by her evil brother Pygmalion, she's going to start forgetting her husband, had begun to make Sychaeus's fade from Dido's memory bit by bit, and tried to waken with new love, a living love, her long-settled mind and dormant heart. After the first pause in the feast, and after trenchers were taken off, they put out wine bowls, grand and garlanded. A festive din now rose and echoed through the palace halls. Lighted lamps hung from the coffered ceiling, rich with gold leaf, and torches with high flames prevailed over the night. And now the queen, Dido, called for a vessel heavy with gems and gold that Belus, her father, and his line had always used. Line 995. She filled it, dipping wine, and her long hall fell silent. Jupiter, she prayed, you make the laws for host and guest. She's talking about Xenia. They say, grant that this day be one of joy for Tyrians and men of Troy. Grant that it be remembered by our descendants. Now be with us, Bacchus, giver of happiness, and kindly Juno, and all you Tyrians attend in friendliness this meeting that unites us. So that's like her toast. Line 1005. At this she tilted a libation out and put the vessel lightly to her lips, then with a jest gave it to Bitias, who nearly immersed himself in brimming gold as he drank down the foaming wine. The bowl passed then to other lords, and Lord Eopas, he's a singer and a poet, with flowing hair, whom giant Atlas taught, made the room echo to his golden lyre. So he's praying music. He sang the straying moon and toiling sun, the origin of mankind and the beasts, of rain and fire and rainy Hyades, Arcturus, this is about a bright star that signifies bad weather, the great bear and little bear, the reason winter suns are in such haste to dip in the ocean, and what holds the nights endless in winter. So he's just singing all about what they feel is the story of creation. Tyrians at this redoubled their applause, the Trojans followed, and Dido, fated queen, drew out the night with talk of various matters, while she drank long draughts of love. Often she asked of Priam, often of Hector, now of the armor Memnon, the son of Dawn, had worn, now on the team Diomedes drove, now of the huge Achilles. So she's asking questions and getting all the answers. Come rather, then, she said, dear guest, and tell us from the beginning the Greek stratagems, the ruin of your town and your seafaring, and now the seventh summer brings you here. So it's been 7 years since Troy fell. Brings you here from wandering all the lands and all the seas. And that is the end of book one.